It is Friday, July the 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, the U.S. Democratic Party makes history by nominating Hillary Clinton for president.
Don't let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do. And most of all, don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it.
Also ahead, Turkey-U.S. relations strained by the coup attempt, Russian plan for Aleppo plus rejecting refugee policy in Germany. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Hillary Clinton, a fixture in the American political scene for a generation, is the Democratic Party's nominee for president. She is the first American woman to become a majority party's presidential nominee. 68-year-old Clinton, President Obama's Secretary of State from 2009 to 2013, appeared briefly with him on Wednesday on the stage at the National Election of the Democratic Party in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. After that, he delivered a ringing endorsement of her as his successor.
And now I'm ready to pass the baton and do my part as a private citizen. So this year, in this election, I'm asking you to join me to reject cynicism and reject fear and to summon what is best in us to elect Hillary Clinton as the next president of the United States and show the world we still believe in the promise of this great nation.
Here is some of what Clinton told the delegates at the Democratic Party convention late Thursday. Part of her focus was on Donald Trump, who became the Republican Party's presidential nominee a week ago.
Our country's motto is E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, we are one. Will we stay true to that motto? Well, we heard Donald Trump's answer last week at his convention. He wants to divide us from the rest of the world and from each other. He's betting that the perils of today's world will blind us to its unlimited promise. He's taken the Republican Party a long way, from morning in America to midnight in America. He wants us to fear the future and fear each other. Well, you know, a great Democratic president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came up with the perfect rebuke to Trump more than 80 years ago during a much more perilous time. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Now, we are clear-eyed about what our country is up against, but we are not afraid. We will rise to the challenge, just as we always have. We will not build a wall. Instead, we will build an economy where everyone who wants a good job can get one. And we'll build a path to citizenship for millions of immigrants who are already contributing to our economy. We will not ban a religion. We will work with all Americans and our allies to fight and defeat terrorism. Yet we know there is a lot to do. Too many people haven't had a pay raise since the crash. There's too much inequality, too little social mobility, too much paralysis in Washington, too many threats at home and abroad. But just look for a minute at the strengths we bring as Americans to meet these challenges. We have the most dynamic and diverse people in the world. We have the most tolerant and generous young people we've ever had. We have the most powerful military, the most innovative entrepreneurs, the most enduring values. Freedom and equality, justice and opportunity. We should be so proud that those words are associated with us. I have to tell you, as your Secretary of State, I went to 112 countries. When people hear those words, they hear America. So, don't let anyone tell you that our country is weak. We're not. Don't let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do. And most of all, don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it. Yes? Those were actually Donald Trump's words in Cleveland. And they should set off alarm bells for all of us. Really? I alone can fix it? Isn't he forgetting troops on the front lines, police officers and firefighters who run toward danger, doctors and nurses who care for us, teachers who change lives, entrepreneurs who see possibilities in every problem, mothers who lost children to violence, and are building a movement to keep other kids safe? He's forgetting every last one of us. Americans don't say, I alone can fix it. We say, we'll fix it together.
That was Hillary Clinton accepting the Democratic Party's nomination for U.S. president late Thursday at the party's national convention. Now we look at what's happening on social media surrounding that convention in Philadelphia. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. The big stories online Thursday all seem to have this in common, the nominees' families. Let's start with Chelsea Clinton. She trended on social media even before her speech because of her interview with Glamour magazine. On Facebook Live, she was asked about her thoughts on her friend, Ivanka Trump, specifically about her speech at RNC last week. When Ivanka Trump was introducing her father, she asserted he's a feminist and would fight for equal pay for women. To that, Chelsea Clinton asked, now, how would your father do that? And argued the Republican nominee has yet to present concrete ways to execute the plans he promised to his supporters.
Yeah, I understand, G. What about Trump's wife, Melania Trump? It looks like MelaniaTrump.com now redirects visitors to Trump.com.
That's right. Her website was taken offline after some people questioned her academic credentials. She tweeted and wrote on her Facebook that it was removed because it does not accurately reflect my current business and professional interests.
That's quite a vague statement. What does it mean?
It's widely thought to be about her claims of having a graduate degree from the University of Slovenia. This is a top comment to her Facebook post. A user named Liza wrote, "Not that it doesn't reflect your current business and professional interests, but you lied that you graduated from the University of Slovenia with a degree when you actually only completed a year and flunked a couple of your exams." But to counter that comment, another person named Brian wrote, "I don't know and I don't care. You got my vote. I've turned off the hoopla media and just waiting until November. No worries. Be happy." Apart from that, many people are still talking about Joe Biden's speech Wednesday night when he mentioned his late son, Beau Biden. Steve, back to you.
Many thanks to you, G, our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. Among the stories we're following here on The Voice of America, Spain's king asking the prime minister to form a new government, U.S. blasting South Sudan's leaders for failures after a spike in sexual assaults, plus re-entering Chinese rockets sparking a California light show. Those stories a lot more at voanews.com and always on our VOA mobile app. This year's U.S. Democratic National Convention was held, as we've said already, in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and as we've noted before, it's a historic city dating back to the formation of the United States. VOA's Kane Farabaugh is in Philadelphia with a bit of the city's history.
It takes a lot to impress historian David Eisenhower. After all, as the grandson of President Dwight Eisenhower and son-in-law of President Richard Nixon, he grew up in the White House, surrounded by history. But it's Philadelphia's history, and moments like the one he had visiting the city's popular landmark, Independence Hall, that have left the biggest impression.
And looking around at the seats and realizing where you were was really quite an experience. It was unforgettable.
That's because it's not just an historic building. It's the epicenter of the American Revolution, the place where the country's leaders charted the path forward for a new nation.
It is a celebration of America's origins.
The three crucial documents that are the legal basis for our country, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, all were written here. No one else can say that.
And no one else can say they own early drafts of those documents, except for the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. They are displayed as part of an organized effort called Political Fest, promoting Philadelphia's history to the tens of thousands of people visiting for the Democratic National Convention. At the nearby Library Company of Philadelphia, visitors can see a book annotated by Thomas Jefferson, a lock of George Washington's hair, and a plaster mask of Abraham Lincoln, made during his lifetime. Lee Arnold hopes those visiting the city will remember more than the history made at the convention.
I want every person in Philadelphia during this time to get on that plane smarter than when they got off it. I want them to learn something.
They also might leave with more than just a history lesson, thanks to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania's unique collection.
We're also one of the largest genealogical libraries in the country. We don't just concentrate on Pennsylvania. We collect genealogy for every state east of the Mississippi River.
And among the many historical documents is a lengthy memoir outlining military life in colonial New York, handwritten by a Continental Army officer in 1776.
And it's in the year of independence.
Absolutely. So we're actually just very close to after independence was declared. That's right.
The signed name at the end of this 240-year-old document is Colonel Samuel Attlee, who served under General George Washington during the Revolutionary War. He is this reporter's ancestor, the brother of my fifth great-grandfather.
Not everyone can get back that far, and not everyone can have a connection to where someone sat and wrote on a piece of paper about their experiences, then you're able to sit and hold it in your hand and look at it as a relative. It's really wonderful.
And while I can't take the physical letter with me, the memory of holding this personal history in my hand is the kind of souvenir Lee Arnold hopes many more will experience while they are here in Philadelphia. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And from Washington, this is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is expected to embark on a major shakeup of his country's armed forces, 2 weeks after a military-led coup, and that was a failed attempt, prompting an ongoing crackdown in the country. This week, hundreds of military personnel suspected of being sympathizers of the exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen were dismissed, and dozens of media outlets were closed. Gulen, who lives in the U.S. now, is accused of being behind the failed July 15th coup. He has denounced that coup and denies any involvement. Gulen said the Turkish leader, in his words, is blackmailing the U.S. by threatening to curb his country's support for the international coalition against the Islamic State unless Gulen is extradited. Gulen said Washington must resist. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby says while Washington backs the effort to bring those who took part in the failed coup to justice, the widening crackdown is a troubling trend that limits legitimate political discourse.
We have urged President Erdogan to show restraint, to act within the rule of law, and to avoid actions that would lead to further violence and instability. We obviously support bringing the perpetrators of the coup to justice, and we also continue to stress the importance of upholding democratic principles and the rule of law through the process.
Kirby called for a measured, deliberate approach to the government's investigation and encouraged it to observe the rule of law and due process. Aaron Stein, an expert on Turkey at the Washington-based Atlantic Council, tells my colleague Victor Beatty that Erdogan's crackdown has widespread support in the country.
And I would say a vast majority of Turks believe that the crackdown is both justified and matches with what took place. And so there is a narrative clash going on between, say, the Western countries and Turkey about the way in which to respond to this coup attempt. What we need to be concerned about is not so much the crackdown, is that well over 40% now of Turkish admirals and generals have been implicated and discharged from the military for alleged involvement in this attempted coup. And so you have a top level of the Turkish military, a member of NATO, whose most senior officers, half of which have been discharged, for alleged involvement in this.
Is it a surprise to you the breadth of the crackdown? And the prime minister indicated Wednesday that there's no end in sight with regard to this crackdown.
The crackdown needs to be viewed again within context of what's been going on in Turkey. You know, since, I would say, January 2014, there's been wide-scale purges of people suspected of being allied with Fethullah Gulen, the guy that the Turks claim is masterminded the attempted coup. And so these lists, or at least these people who are being forced to resign or being fired from their positions, are part and parcel of this larger thing that has been taking place. And I do think that the government believes that now is their time. They have political support for this. Now is the time to eradicate their influence within the Turkish bureaucracy completely. Otherwise, you risk losing the coalition supporting you domestically.
Is there a Gulen faction firmly entrenched in Turkish society?
They don't have much political power, and I would say that Gulenists in general, as a movement, have incredibly high unfavorable ratings. And so that's one of the reasons why the purges have considerable support inside of Turkey. But I think what the big question, it's the million-dollar question, and nobody quite knows because the movement is very opaque and there's not a lot of trust in the Turkish government, a lot of the claims, is how much Gulenist infiltration is there within the bureaucracy and to what degree the burden of proof is being put upon these people for actually affiliation with the movement as they're being forced to resign or being purged.
Aaron, there's a large-scale shakeup of the Turkish armed forces expected to be announced as early as Thursday when its Supreme Military Council meets. What impact will this have on the fight against Islamic State and Turkey's membership in NATO?
I mean, I think for the U.S. particularly, it won't have very much effect, again, because the air base from which the strikes are being opened, I think, will be largely left untouched. And the U.S. isn't asking Turkey to do very much in the fight against Islamic State, simply police the border and leave the air base open. The way in which this will boomerang is that for the Turkish component of the Islamic State, they could become more active inside Turkey itself. So Turkey faces a far greater threat, I think, now from ISIS, just because the security apparatus is in a little bit of disarray right now, and they're being asked to concentrate on a very wide-scale threats. And so they have to pick and choose, and ISIS could fall by the wayside.
That's Aaron Stein. He's with the Atlantic Council here in Washington, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. A new Russian military proposal to establish four corridors to allow civilians and rebels to leave the northern Syrian city of Aleppo is being studied right now by UN officials. Lisa Schlein reporting from the UN in Geneva.
News of the Russian military proposal came while the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, was attending a weekly meeting of the Humanitarian Access Task Force. De Mistura says he and his colleagues were taken by surprise.
It is premature for me and others to actually make any comments until we have further details and on what has been and is the Russian proposal or initiative.
Under the Russian proposal, civilians reportedly will be allowed to leave Aleppo through three routes and rebels through a fourth. An estimated 300,000 people are trapped in Aleppo. Government forces are encircling the city, making it impossible for aid agencies to bring in food, medicine, and other essential supplies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel says she firmly rejects calls to reverse her policy to welcome refugees to Germany. AFP reporting that Merkel made the statement following a series of fatal attacks in the country. She says those who launched the attacks wanted to undermine Germany's sense of community as well as openness and willingness to help the people in need. Also, media reports by the U.S. State Department has warned that Malta needs to do more to combat human trafficking. State Department says that Malta is a source country, in other words, a destination country for sex and labor trafficking. It says Malta has yet to meet the minimum standards for addressing that problem. And in related news, a new migrant awareness campaign has been launched. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the development. She speaks now from Rome with VOA's Joe DiCapua about that campaign.
The International Organization for Migration has joined the Italian government in a new campaign called Aware Migrants. And this is quite an interesting campaign launched to give migrants more information about the risks they face so that they can make informed decisions before they leave their countries of origin. And one of the themes is it is time to open your eyes. And this campaign is driven by the migrants themselves. They are telling their own stories of survival and abuse that they've suffered. And some of these stories are going to be featured on a new website called awaremigrants.org.
Did the IOM and Italian authorities explain how this program would be distributed in Africa, for example? How do they get the word out?
Well, they're going to use social media as much as possible. So through the website and through other social networks, they're going to be promoting video testimonies from migrants who are speaking out about their experience. They've also recorded audio testimonies gathered and recorded in Niger through smartphones. And those testimonies will be available for download from the website and also be broadcast on local radio stations. The video clips, incidentally, will be in English, French, Arabic, and also some local dialects with some subtitles. So some very powerful information here, and we saw some interesting video testimonies today. One migrant called Chamba from West Africa said in his video testimony, it is a road that leads to hell, and he spoke about how he cried like a baby when the people smuggler that he was dealing with forced him, his wife, and his small baby to get on a boat in very stormy conditions with no regard for their lives, no concern about the future of his wife and child. So that gives you one example of one of the testimonies that was very powerful at the press conference today.
So this is obviously an attempt to slow the migration to Europe.
It's interesting that both the Italian government and the International Organization of Migration really wants to go to the source and really try and make people aware of the potential violence that they might suffer, the exploitation they might suffer. As they launched this campaign, they talked about the 3,000 migrants who've already died making that perilous journey from North Africa to try and reach Europe just this year.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna. She's in Rome, and she was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that in the known universe, about 90% of the biggest black holes are dormant. Because they're dormant, these black holes aren't pumping out radiation or any kind of light. But all it takes is for a star or some other object to ambble close by to awaken it and kickstart a feeding frenzy, which scientists call a tidal disruption. Astronomers at the University of Maryland, for the first time, found signs of a tidal disruption after observing X-rays bouncing off the walls of an accretion disk, the gathering of matter around the black hole that forms as it devours material. The scientists say this black hole consumed material so fast that it even briefly surpassed the Eddington limit, which is the theoretical maximum speed of how fast a black hole can actually ingest matter. The UMD team says their finding can help astronomers understand how supermassive black holes grow. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. When this year's Rio Olympics begin next week, more than 130,000 police, soldiers, and security guards will be working to keep those games safe with high-in-the-sky monitors, very much the cutting-edge high-tech cameras. Developed for the U.S. military and tested in Iraq and Afghanistan, a high-resolution imaging system is called Cimera. It will provide real-time video surveillance of an area about 40 square kilometers. Opening ceremony for the 2016 Olympics will be taking place on Friday, August the 5th in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Competitions beginning the following day. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's election season here in the United States. Don't forget to go to voanews.com for the absolute latest. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 28th, we observe the 65th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of one of the most important humanitarian documents of the modern era, the UN Convention relating to the status of refugees. Better known as the 1951 Refugee Convention, it is a multilateral treaty that defines who is a refugee and sets out the rights of individuals who are granted asylum. The Refugee Convention is the first international agreement dealing with the most fundamental aspects of a refugee's life, beginning with the requirement that signatory nations must protect all refugees that are on their territory. It also stipulates that refugees must be allowed certain freedoms, including the right to practice their religion, the right to work, and the right to acquire an education. They must be allowed access to travel documents and should be allowed freedom of movement. The UN Refugee Convention also emphasizes that refugees have certain obligations to the host government, such as to respect the laws and regulations of their country of asylum. Most importantly, the convention makes it very clear that a refugee may not be repatriated involuntarily to a country where he or she fears persecution. The document stemmed from the refugee crisis of 1945, when over 40 million people who were displaced by the Second World War flooded Europe in need of resettlement. Today we find ourselves in the midst of another refugee crisis, the largest the world has seen since the catastrophe that spurred the creation of the document in the first place. According to UNHCR estimates, more than 20 million people around the world meet the convention's definition of a refugee. On this, the 65th anniversary of the signing of one of the cornerstone documents that defines our common humanity, let us not forget our history and work toward never repeating it again. Let us open our hearts to refugees wherever they are, help however and whenever we can, until such a time that they can make their way back home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.